Hello, welcome to Growing Wild on Radio Reverb. I'm Charlotte Petz. This is 97.2 FM and it's Christmas Day. This is tremendously exciting. I hope you're all having a lovely time. Got full bellies by now, had a couple of gifts, a couple of arguments, a duff cracker, and got some sort of sprout situation happening. Well, settle down, and here's what's coming up on the show today. We go tracking and trailing with John Ryder of the Woodcraft School in the woodland of West Sussex. We're going to hear from the folk of Save Our Green Spaces, who held a protest earlier in the month outside Hove Town Hall. So we're going to hear what that was all about. And finally, we're going to have Nigel taking us through what it is to hunt for rabbit using the age-old method of falconry. But before all that, we're going to have a song. And it's Christmas and I have to play a Christmas song. So this might be the only one that's in the show. I haven't decided yet, but it's a belter. I do love that horse at the end. That was the Ronettes and Sleigh Ride. All-time favourite Christmas song. It changes every year. That's my favourite this year. Okay, so let's go on to the first section of the show. Now, I went over to Mid-Sussex, where I met up with John Ryder, who is a naturalist and a woodsman, and he's a certified wildlife tracker. And he's founded his own bushcraft school, which is called the Woodcraft School. And it's brilliant. I've done a couple of courses over there. Quite recently, actually, I did one in the summer, which was wild food and medicine. And previously, I've done a bushcraft course. So this guy I just have a lot of respect for and have learnt an awful lot from. But I've never really got into the tracking side of things. And I knew that he was particularly good at that and particularly keen on that. So I wanted to go over and meet him and learn a little bit about what it is to go tracking and trailing And I didn't even realise they were two different things. So there's two different methods, and it's track and sign and trailing. I mean, they both lead into each other because you can't really do one without the other. So this is me and John having a walk through the woodland, and this is me doing my best Claire Balding from Ramblings personation of trying to describe the surroundings. We are walking down a path in some woodland in West Sussex, and there's a lot of leaf litter on the floor. It's a drizzly grey December day, and it's quite wet underfoot, and we are looking for signs of animals, some tracks to follow. Well, how do we start? What do we look for? Is it better to look in the muddier areas, the wetter areas, or will the rain have affected that too much and washed away any tracks?
Both, really. Obviously, if you can find somewhere that will hold a track and areas of activity. So we have got this old pheasant pen here. There's points where the pheasants have been fed, which obviously will concentrate birds and the things that are interested in the birds as well. And also, it's just a good thoroughfare. So animals, a bit like people, are going to go for the line of least resistance. So even when they're really spooked, if they know the area, it's unlikely they just go crashing out through the undergrowth. Even when you flush them, in effect, deer, etc., will follow known paths, so they don't like to crash through brambles any more than we do. So in here we've got muntjac deer and we've got roe deer, and what they're also trying to do is, those two guys are territorial, so they're trying to sort of wander about at regular intervals and feed. So this is a good place to look because there's food sources. If we look along, there's brambles all the way along here, and it's a muddy patch, so it's going to take a track. And we have got a track here, actually.
Ooh!
Which is a bit washed out. And this is... it's actually a muntjac track. It looks a lot bigger than it really is. What we've got to look at when we're looking at tracks is the actual base of the track. So there's some slippage. Kind of got to look at where the wall of the track starts to come up. And when you do that, you can actually lose maybe 20% of it and pull it up, which makes this thing just over an inch, which is a little bit small for a roe deer, I would say.
Okay, because the difference between muntjac and roe deer is the size, isn't it?
Predominantly,
small.
they're very small. And the other thing to look at when you're looking at the tracks is they're usually the cleats, which are the two individual toes here, are much more parallel. Whereas in a roe deer, they will spread out and become more heart-shaped.
Okay.
We've got the other track here, which is the hind track that's come in just behind the front. Mm. So you've got to think with animals that they've got four legs. So when they're walking or trotting, then the hind feet will land somewhere in relation to the front
course.
Tree.
Yeah, so the front print will be next door to the back.
Well, it could be slightly behind it. So if we're walking, and it doesn't really matter where you start, but if the animal's walking, the hind left will lift up, and just before it touches down, then the left front one has to move out of the way. And generally speaking, because of the speeds of walk, the further the foot goes forward, the faster the animal's likely to be. So, and then when they start galloping and trotting, it's completely different.
Yeah.
But these guys will leave regular patterns where you'll have a front and a front and a hind on a walk or a trot. And you can tell the speed just from looking at the tracks. Fallow, red deer, seeker, guys that have big antlers, and a lot more muscle on the front, you can start to tell front and back because there is a big size difference.
Right.
And certainly with the males, there's an even bigger size difference between the front and the rears because they're carrying muscle and antlers, basically. There's some more marks on the tree over there we can have a look at. So you can see there's this is quite typical of a tree that would be picked for this job. It's a Lawson cypress, so it has this quite tough outer bark, and then when you expose it, it's red underneath. Although they will do it on all sorts of other trees, and this is squirrel marking, and it's a scent marking process, but it's not a territorial thing because squirrels aren't territorial. They have a home range. But this is like a calling card. So what they do, and it's predominantly males, I think, and they chew into the bark a little bit, and then they rub scent glands on their cheeks onto there. And then other squirrels can come check it out and see who's about, basically. Because this shows up as a sort of russet red colour. They think it's a visual clue as well as a sort of scent.
Yeah, scent, yeah. That's so clever, isn't it?
And it goes all the way up, as you can see. It's often on a prominent tree, and it's often on the sheltered side, so west is over here, so this will hold the scent longer. kind of illustrates what we were talking about. This is actually sort of bramble, it's a wild rose, but you can see that the there's no greenery left on here, no leaves, and I know it's autumn, but if you look carefully at the ends of the twigs, you can see they've been snipped off.
Yeah.
But they're ragged as well, so they're not a clean snip. And that with the height would suggest it's a deer, because they only have front incisors on the lower jaw, and then they have a hard palate on the top, so they always leave this tearing
effect.
So you won't get a clean cut. If it's something like a rabbit or a hare, which will also eat these things, it's like it's been cut with scissors. Oh, there's a fox back there, I think. It's a bit washed out. Just got to look at it from two angles, really, because it's so washed out, I'm trying to see which way it's going. I think it's going that way. So this, I would say, is the front foot of a fox, because it's much rounder than the rear foot, more weight. So generally speaking, animals with even length legs have bigger front feet. With badgers, with foxes, with dogs, it's that bigger sort of surface they follow. If we go back to sort of the basics of tracking, if you put your own hand down on the ground, starting with the thumb, this is what we would call toe number one. Animals have the same basic design, all mammals do, really. And then, so it goes one from the thumb, two, three, four, five is the little finger. Now, on canines, number one has disappeared pretty much on the hind leg. Some domestic dogs still show it as a dew claw. And then we have toe number two and toe number five that are set back. And then that leaves toe number three and toe number four as the pads that are facing forward. So if you think about a dog, that's essentially toes. There you go, it's a badger. So there's the other one.
Oh,
see,
yeah.
All these toes in a row?
Yeah.
So we've got the pad back in here, which is quite broad, and then all of these toes are in a row. And oftentimes, although they walk with the whole of their heel flat, but generally they're like us. They're plantigrades, as it's called. Sole walkers is the other way to think about it. So the whole of their surface is potentially going to contact with the ground. And most of the time, all the toes are ahead of the palm pad. So you can see these are ahead of this big pad here.
Yeah. I can already feel how exciting it would be to be able to track something and then see it. I can imagine that just being a reward.
Even with a camera, even without a camera, the adrenaline's amazing.
Yeah.
When you try and get as close as you can. This is owl scat.
Owl scat.
If you see white chalky droppings under a tree and there's no solids in them, it's quite likely to be an owl or a bird of prey at least. Yeah.
It just looks a bit like paint, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
We'll get on there shortly.
Okay.
So birds of prey create what they call mutes, where they lift their tail and they squirt them in a line.
Lovely.
And owls don't, they just drop down. So the fact that just dropped down at the base of the tree would suggest it's more likely to be an owl as well. Okay. So some of these things are guesses, but hopefully they're educated guesses.
Looking quite normally through this along this ride. And I don't know why, but I suppose when I thought about it, I think, you know, sort of creeping, kind of trying not to disturb anything, going really slowly. And is that just not how it works?
No, it is if you're following.
Okay.
So when you're trailing, that's... when you're just looking for tracks and sign, as we're doing at the moment, then we're not expecting those to sort of run away.
Yeah.
But you're still looking a long way ahead. You know, you're not staring at your feet, because if you're trailing something and you're staring at your feet, chances are it's going to spot you before you spot it.
Right.
So you're still always trying to look at sign as far ahead as you can, 5 to 10 yards probably. So you get what they call a flow going with the tracking. Right. You're still moving quietly, but you are moving. You're moving quite slowly. So if we pull this back, you can see the hole of that hoof wall. It's quite big and it's quite wide as well. So the other side is in here. So you could, it's very subtle, but that's a road track, and it's pushed the leaves up here. But it's not as fresh as what we saw before. You can see it's had rain.
It has, yeah, it's sort of smooshed.
There's more road tracks again. You can see these.
Quite a few,
yeah. So this is this backwards and forwards thing, because the territorial, it doesn't mean there's lots of deer. It's probably the same one or two.
What
just going
one,
up and down.
What makes one breed territorial and the other not?
It's probably food,
right,
to be honest. So if you think about fallow deer and roe deer, there's some marking here on these trees, but fallow deer as opposed to roe deer. So fallow deer are more grazers. They'll go out and munch a hell of a lot, and they just have a home range. but they're not territorial, so they're not actively defending it. It doesn't mean you won't find them in the same area. But roe deer are browsers, so they're taking small amounts of food more regularly. And when you're a browser, you can't support 20 or 30 other animals browsing.
Okay, so they get a bit more bolshy about their pack.
Yeah, so they hang on to it. I mean, there's a lot of mystery about animal behaviour that we're still guessing at a little bit, I think. Also, roe will take the tops out of trees, which is, foresters hate them for that. Because they're just browsing, they're nibbling all the sweet stuff.
All the crown, yeah.
And then you'll get a tree that will potentially become forked because its leader's been eaten out.
Yeah.
And it devalues it for timber.
Deer are quite a big pest, really.
Yeah, well, they're there's nothing to control them.
We removed their natural predator.
Exactly.
And then we don't really hunt them.
No. Well, not in sufficient numbers to keep them down, that's for sure.
Yeah, because it was the wolf, wasn't it?
Yeah, and lynx as well.
And lynx.
So if you go into... I spent quite a lot of time in Europe with wildlife, and if you go into Eastern Europe, the red deer tend to be... Because our native deer are red and roe, the same as Europe. Fallow have been introduced. Sitka of... Sitka? That's a spruce, isn't it? Sitka deer have been introduced.
They're
Chinese
pretty.
Water deer, yeah. Muntjac, all introduced. So we've only really got roe and red. And in Europe, the wolves tend to focus on the reds, and lynx will go for roe, certainly young roe. So that keeps them down, obviously.
So it's quite local to Britain that we've done that. In Europe, they've still got wolves and...
Yeah, and they're coming back because they're a protected species. I think the general agreement, or the European agreement, is if it was native, and you should make efforts to reintroduce it if possible, and if it gets here on its own, then... You know, it's still protected.
Right.
Whereas because we're an island, obviously, they're not going to get here on their own.
Mm.
And I don't think our government are very interested in introducing them.
Is there a time of year that it's better than other times of year? You know, is there an optimum? Because obviously there is a lot of leaf litter. And I know that we can still see some prints, you know, maybe the heavier things that make more of an indent. But you don't see quite as much as you maybe could do without it.
The late autumn, early winter isn't the easiest, but it's probably the best sign for trailing animals because the disturbance. You know, when the leaves are down, all the old trails get covered up, as you've seen. So anything that moves on it,
it's
going to be relatively fresh. And straight after rain, it's the same thing with trailing, because if you can pick up this is ideal. Although it's raining, it's great for trailing. Because if we find anything, it's going to be so easy to age it, because everything else is full of water. Those tracks I saw back there that were fresh, and they were the only fresh animal tracks we'd seen. So you can be pretty sure they're just a matter of a couple of hours old.
Right.
Because everything else is washed out and full of water. I don't know, I just think people should just go out there and see what they can find.
Just whenever.
It's like having kids, it's never a right time. If you wait till you could afford it, you'd never have a child either. I think you can put things off, but you should just get out there and have a look, really. It's such an inexpensive way of getting people to connect with nature, and it's quite profound, really, I think. I've been involved in the outdoors all my life, and there's nothing like particularly trailing an animal to give you that connection. You know, people talk about nature connection a lot, but and it hasn't happened to me very many times, but you can get into this flow state that people talk about, where you're kind of quite relaxed, but you're noticing absolutely everything. And I guess that's once you've had that, it's such a high that you're kind of constantly trying to look for it. Where you're on the trail and you know you're on the trail, but you're noticing the bird song and the alarm calls and the way the wind's going, and there's nothing else that I've quite experienced that's been made me feel quite such a part of the woods as trailing.
It was so interesting doing that piece and learning all those. It's just picking up the tiniest little dents in plants and rubbings on bark on trees, which deer do when they're in rut or in season, and seeing how they rub in between their antlers on the wood to leave their scent behind. And just all these things that when you're going for a walk, you don't necessarily notice. And as soon as you can tune in and see it, all of this life is around us and living alongside us, but we just don't see it all the time. So just to pick up on the markings of that and how fresh some of those tracks were. So just because of the rain and because it does wash away the tracks. Anything that we did find was really quite fresh. So just a few moments ahead of us, these deer and badgers were scurrying off in front of us. So it was quite exciting. In fact, we did do a little bit of trailing. So with the track and sign is what we were predominantly doing there, which is picking up the prints and where they've eaten, where they've been grazing, and the rubbings on the trees and things like that. So that's for us to know what animals are living in that area. And trailing is much more to actually, as it suggests, to find the animals. So that didn't make such great radio because you have to be so quiet. And they pick up on our smell and on our sounds. So we did do a little bit after I turned off the microphone, and it was really exciting. And we found these trails that went off into the woods, and with the leaves on the ground, you can really see the scuffs, and you could see a path that some deer had made. So we followed that. Well, I was trying to follow it. I kept sort of going in the wrong direction, but John's a really good teacher, so he was very patient with me. And then we did end up finding these beds where the deer had slept, probably just the night before. So I can only imagine what it would be like to learn those skills and then actually find where the animals are and see them. And John says he hunts with a camera. That's his thing. And just being, he uses a 300mm camera, so you have to get really quite close. So using those skills to then be able to get up and take a picture would be lovely. And I know some, obviously, people do it for hunting as well, which, as probably came, you may have heard in that clip, I'm not actually adverse to, because deer, as much as they are beautiful, majestic creatures, there are a lot of them, and it is human intervention that has created that, because we have removed the natural predators. So it falls on us to be that now, and we do have to manage the numbers of deer in the countryside, because they are incredibly destructive. I mean, the argument obviously is that humans are a lot more so, but we can't really manage ourselves in that way because we go to jail. So we do, but it's our responsibility to manage the rest of the countryside, especially if we've meddled in it so much by removing so many of the creatures. So to hear that some of them are coming back, we had a chat about, they're called pine martins, and their numbers of those just went way down. They're kind of like a bigger stoat, and they help control the numbers of grey squirrels, because originally they grew up with the red squirrel. So they would have gone for them, but because we've had such a huge influx of grey squirrels, and grey squirrels are kind of heavier, they're a little bit slower, then they're starting to go for them, and so that's reducing the numbers naturally. And that's the best way of managing these things, is just to allow the ecosystems to exist as they should, and we just need to just stop interfering in that way and fearing so much. So you can find out more about John and all of the courses that he runs. You can learn how to do that at the school that he's founded. And I'll put all the links for that on the Growing Wild show page on radioreverb.com. All the links will be on there. But it's called Woodcraft School. And if that interests you, then I really recommend going there. They're very, very good. Okay, let's have a song. And then we'll be down at the Hove Town Hall finding out what was happening there earlier in the month.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming each night of his charms that won't get too into his arms. So if you're looking to find love, you can share. Love him and show him that you care. Show him that you care just for him. Do the things he likes to do. Wear your hair just for him. 'Cause he won't get in thinking and praying, wishing and hoping, just wishing and hoping and thinking and praying. it harder in kissing, in squeezing, and loving. Yeah, just do it, and after you do, you will be his. You gotta show him that you care just for him. Do the things he likes to do. Wear your hair just for him, 'cause you won't get him singing and playing, wishing and hoping, just wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming. His kisses will start that won't get too into his heart. So if you're thinking of heartbreak, true love is, all you gotta do is hold him and kiss him and squeeze him and love him. Yeah, just do it, and after you do,
Dusty Springfield and Wishing and a Hoopin. It's kind of the early days of text, isn't it? And OGs on the end there. I bet they were outraged in the 60s. Let's get on to SOGS. Now, this stands for Save Our Green Spaces. Earlier in the month, they held a protest down at Hove Town Hall when there was a meeting around the proposed cuts that are coming to our parks and green spaces. We've already suffered quite a big blow to those already, and the proposal is a further £600,000 cut coming into effect next year. Now, there's a lot of groups in and around Brighton. You know, you've got Friends of Preston Park, Friends of the Level. There's so many. There's all of these brilliant groups of volunteers that help our parks look like they do, and they're kind of like the silent warriors, really. And they came together to show their solidarity in why they feel it's important that we don't suffer these cuts. So there was this meeting that was happening at Hove Town Hall, and I went down there to have a chat with Chris Todd, who is who you'll hear next, who's kind of created this Save Our Green Spaces group, which is basically the umbrella group for all of the smaller groups within Brighton. And I asked Chris what it was that they were doing down there.
We want to send a strong message to the council that it just cannot keep cutting funding for parks and open spaces. They're a vital part of the life for people in Brighton and Hove. It's an important asset, and if we keep running it down, then in the future potentially kids won't have playgrounds to play on, we won't have green spaces where we can walk through, and you know, a lot of sports clubs will have closed down already. We've lost quite a few of them.
So what are the proposed cuts that are coming? Why is there another? There's been some, and now there's a heftier lot arriving. Is that why you're more fired up to do something about it, or what's the current situation?
Well, since 2008, we've seen a 25% cut in real terms already, and the council's now talking about another £600,000 coming out of the budget in the next few years. And if anyone who sort of already volunteers and helps look after some of these areas knows that the service is stretched already. And another 600,000, I think, will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. It will really completely wreck the parks and open spaces facility that the council's got. The idea is that everyone's coming together under the Save Our Green Spaces or SOGS banner. But you can see we've got CPRE Sussex, we've got Friends of White Hawk Hill, we've got Friends of Queen's Park, probably got Friends of Preston Park, you know, all sorts of different, and we've got the allotments as well. So we've got all sorts of Friends of the Level, we've all got all sorts of different groups, you know, coming together, very, very concerned about what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, so it was a really good turnout. There were quite a few people there, and then some people then went on to go into the meeting to hear what happened. And as these things go, it's a very slow process, so there won't be really any further information until the next meeting, which is to be held on the 17th of January to hear about the open spaces strategy and priorities cuts. So it's really up to us to make some noise about this. It's just so important that we don't let the parks and the green spaces in this city diminish, because we do take them for granted and we just assume that they're there and they just somehow always look really nice. A lot of work goes into that, and it does need money, and if that gets cut anymore, then the things that will suffer because of it, it's just basically we will suffer because of it. And it's not just, they're not a luxury, it's actually been proven how much green spaces help our mental health. You know, we all know what it's like to do a day in the office and it feels quite stressful, and just be able to go for a walk at lunchtime through a park can really change that. And that's just something on a small scale. You know, the actual projects that happen within those parks are incredible for supporting people with special needs and all of that sort of thing. So we can do something about this, or we can certainly make our voices heard anyway. And SOGS now exists. You can find them on Twitter and on Facebook, and Save Our Green Spaces, Brighton and Hove, and add your name to the list and maybe get a bit involved with it. I had a chat with some of the others that were down there as well, so let's just hear some of those voices.
Campaign to Protect Rural England. It's one of the older organisations for protection of rural England. It's our 60th anniversary, in fact, this year.
Great. So why is this project important to you?
Well, we're not only interested in green spaces outside the city, but green spaces within the city. They're important wildlife reserves, really. And so we're concerned about any threat to them. As well as being very important for people, they're important for wildlife. Green spaces are very important for health, mental health, well-being, everything. They're very important for everything, really.
My name's Sue Shepherd, and I'm chair of Friends of Preston Park. I've been looking at the state of the parks in Brighton and Hove over the last few years, and I think I'm not alone in being very disturbed about how bad they've got. You know, there are very, very few staff left now because of the recent cuts than there used to be. There used to be many more staff, which is a real shame, because, of course, the parks in Brighton and Hove, as they are everywhere, are not only the lungs of the city, and not only do they have huge historical heritage importance, especially Preston Park with two listed buildings, oldest park in Brighton, oldest municipal park that is, but also they mean a huge amount to people in terms of their physical, mental, spiritual and social health. And they are vital to the community, and they cannot be left to disintegrate.
I love a bit that she said in there, the lungs of the city. Oh, brilliant. It's exactly what they are. Yeah, if you want to get involved in that, like I say, check them out, Facebook, Twitter, Save Our Green Spaces, and put your two penneth in. And I know the tricky thing is that everyone's fighting for funds now. If the cuts don't happen massively in parks, they'll happen somewhere else. And the thing is, they're all as valid as each other. So I know how difficult it is to choose, and the council are in a horrible position to have to do that. And I would really like to speak to someone from the council, actually, and get them on the show and get their point of view, which I'm going to attempt to do as this process continues, because it will take a while before a final decision is made. Because, yeah, they're in a tough place. But I guess it's a bit of a situation where the voice that shouts the loudest gets heard. So if you feel you can contribute to those voices, then do. We have to start being vocal about this stuff. Okay, let's have another song. And then I've got some exciting news to share with you. This is someone I've discovered really quite recently and just utterly fallen in love with.
Days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. 100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart. And a little more before he knows it's all. You know a man can wait upon his true self unfolds. Yes, it
That voice, isn't it incredible? She's called Sharon Jones and is unbelievable. It turns out she did a lot of she worked with Amy Winehouse quite a lot, and you can really hear in that song, can't you, how Amy could have been influenced by that. She's just incredible, but unfortunately did die quite recently, which is sad because I would have loved to have seen her. It sounds like it's really old, doesn't it, but it's actually super recent. So yeah, Sharon Jones, check her out. She's just incredible. Okay, so exciting news that I have for you. My show, Growing Wild, has just picked up a sponsor. So we are now proudly sponsored by Infinity Foods. And if you live in Brighton and Hove, then I'm sure you know who they are. They've got quite a big presence in the city. They are the go-to place for organic and whole foods. And they're involved in lots of projects across the city. So I'm really excited that they have chosen to sponsor this show, and as of next month you will be hearing their name a lot more in the show, and I'm excited to work with them and to have their support. So thank you, Infinity, and let's hope it all goes well. I'm a little bit concerned that this is a very sort of animal meat heavy kind of show so probably quite good to slip this one in before the official sponsorship starts. And we will tread our new path together in January. So, yeah, thank you, Infinity. Now, next up, we have Nigel. Now, I went to go and see Nigel and his friend Kev on some land out in East Sussex, where I knew that they would be flying their hawks, which they do on this particular bit of land to try and, well, for multiple reasons, actually. But it's to try and manage a huge rabbit problem that exists on this land, and also because they're falconers and it's what they love and it's their passion. So this is me talking to Nigel about falconry and the practice of using hawks to control rabbit numbers.
Falconry is an art that goes back thousands of years, and basically it was started to put food in the larder. They used to use a hawk called a goshawk, which is an accipiter, which is a extremely fast, powerful bird, and that's what filled the larders up for the people. years and years ago.
And so what happens? How does this work?
Well, there's many ways of doing it. I use hawks. I don't hunt with falcons. That's like your peregrine falcon, which you see, which will stoop and take a bird out of the sky. What we do here, we're actually all stringers, really. We fly hawks. And what we're doing, we're putting the ferrets down, which bolt the rabbit. And when the rabbit runs, hopefully, in theory, the bird should catch the rabbit. They don't catch everyone. They say 3 out of 10 is a good amount.
Okay.
It all depends on fitness. If the rabbit's fitter than the bird, that's nature. It's a partnership between falconer, hawk, and in our case, the ferrets. Some people use dogs. I don't use dogs. And what we do, we put the ferret down. The ferret smells out the rabbit. It bolts the rabbit. And then it's a challenge of the fittest, really. If the rabbit is fit, 9 times out of 10 it will get away.
Yeah.
If it doesn't and the hawk catches it, it's my duty as a falconer to get in as quick as I can and dispatch the rabbit humanely, so it doesn't suffer.
With the hawk going in to kill it, is it looking for food for itself?
Yes. At the end of the day, it's a natural thing for it to do, to hunt and catch its dinner.
Mm.
But we change that slightly. We reward that bird. When it takes the rabbit, we give it a fair reward. So it knows it's like a game, really. If I catch that thing that's running through the woods, I'm going to get a nice, big, fat, juicy titbit.
Would you feed it rabbit? Do you do
yes,
that?
Yes, we do feed rabbit.
Do? Yeah.
Early on, you drag a dead rabbit or a dummy rabbit. It's all part of the process. Whereas the mother would teach it to chase and they're watching the parent. We haven't always got another bird we can do that with.
Mm.
So we drag a dummy bunny, we put a bit of food on it. It's rewarded for catching that. And you then just gradually transform. You move further and further along until your bird starts catching rabbits.
Wow. So where do you keep these birds?
We keep them in aviaries. Both myself and Kevin, our birds are free lofted, so they've got the freedom of the aviary. And on a nice sunny day, we'll bring them out, put them on a perch in the garden, fresh water, and they bathe and quite happy there. And they're flown every day.
You can hear in the background a bell ringing,
right.
And that's they're on the birds.
Yes, well, years ago, we go back to medieval times, they didn't have the tracking systems that we have today. Both of our birds have trackers on. I've actually tracked a bird 40 miles with mine in the past. With a hawk, they say you only need 8 to 10 miles. But as you can see, the cover we have here, even in this small area, the bird's only got to chase for 100 yards and grab something. If it's under a tree, the colour of the bird, you just can't see it. So out comes the tracker. It helps you to get in as quick as possible. And it helps locate lost birds.
Yeah. Have you ever lost any?
Well, only until I've tracked them and found them.
So, no.
I have two falcons, which I actually just fly just for fun.
Yeah.
And I've tracked one of those 40 miles.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that quite exciting to do that as well?
No, that's the worst part of falconry. Because number one, you've got to think, why did it disappear in the first place? It's probably a bit too heavy in weight. We don't keep the birds hungry, but we fly them at breakfast time, tea time, dinner time, like they train any animal, really. So you have to keep them sharp, you know, so they have to be wanting to do it. If you fed them in the morning and then took them out, they would literally just sit in a tree all day and you'd have to go back in the evening.
Yeah.
That's where we get the term fed up. It's a falconry term. And you get people on a Sunday, they'll eat their roast dinner, they'll fill themselves up and they'll sit on the sofa and say, oh, I'm fed up. Bored. It doesn't really mean that. It comes from a falconry term. Once I have fed that bird all her rations, she's fed up, and all she will do is sit in the tree, and she'll sit there for 12 hours.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting.
There's lots of things that come from lots of sayings that come from falconry.
Because it's such an old form of, eating.
That's right.
Us. Yeah. Do you find that connection isn't made so much? Do you get people who aren't keen on this as a method of, or is it?
Well, of course you do. You get people that don't agree with any type of blood sport.
Mm.
At the end of the day, this is a blood sport.
Mm.
But we're also doing a favour. As you can see, we have a major problem on this land with rabbits. We do a lot on land where people have got horses, race horses, this sort of thing, it's so easy for a horse to break a leg in a rabbit hole. Mm.
I know here there's a problem with it, with the rabbits uprooting the trees.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's huge. There's huge horn beams that are tilted over because of the warrens that are being built underneath them.
Well, as we stand here now, just looking at this woodland that we're looking at, in this 200-yard square piece of woodland, there has got to be 500 rabbit holes. You know, and it's just unbelievable. This is probably the most holes I see on any of my land that I fly.
I mean, humans have kind of created that
problem. We've created
We've removed so many natural predators. So, I mean, this is where I find it challenging when people flag a problem with this sort of thing maybe happening. Well, we've created the problem by removing the natural predators, so actually it's just a very natural way of dealing with what is now a problem. So,
unfortunately, I think we deal with so much, we mess around with nature so much, it's untrue, and then we're doing other things to try and combat it, like you say, to try and sort it out. It's like the hedgerows. I mean, the reason all the songbirds and all the small birds are depleting and getting smaller and smaller, in my opinion, is the fact that we're taking out all the hedgerows. So there's less room for them to breed. So it's a vicious circle. We bring the rabbit into this country, then we've got too many, so they introduce myxomatosis. It's been here God knows how many years, still not got rid of them. It's us that messes around with nature.
And that's a cruel way of dealing with it as well. This seems, the way you've described it, it's very quick.
It is quick. It's not as quick as a gun, but it is quick. It's the falconer's duty, as I say, to get in as fast as you can and dispatch. Because you're talking about the two birds flying here today weigh 2 pounds. We've caught two rabbits today that weigh 4 pounds. Wow. Now, it's just going to be very, very difficult for that bird. It wouldn't kill it instantly, it's just impossible. But because we're there to help, you can catch that larger quarry. If it was a rat, it would be dead. That was it. The power of the bird, it would just kill it.
Can I ask what you do to dispatch it? What do you have to do?
Basically, you break the rabbit's neck, bang, as soon as you can. Sometimes we use a spike straight through the back of the head. Instant. Absolutely. It's literally less than a second. Bang. And it's the most humane way of doing it. There's one there, she's just come after.
So at this moment, I'm just going to interrupt here because something quite dramatic happened where Nigel got called by his friend Kevin, who was also working his bird at the same time, and Nigel's bird had flown down, got a rabbit, but then, well, you'll hear what happens next, but I wanted to convey just quite how dramatic this was, because we broke the interview and Nigel went running off across this stretch of woodland to go and find his bird, which had started to be pulled down into the hole by the rabbit. So he'd gone running off, and then this is what happened next.
See, that's the part of falconry you don't want.
Well, she just went straight
right in the hole.
Blimey.
Cool, you want to hear her heart? Good girl. That's the fit rabbit, you see.
Right.
Cool.
So right, the rabbit pulled her in, or what happened there?
The rabbit pulled her in the hole.
He's just flown 100 yards and hit the rabbit, but unfortunately it was so close to the hole, the rabbit just went down the hole and it was dragging her in the hole. So it was only her wings that were stopping her going underground.
Wow.
So if I wasn't here, if she wouldn't let it go, she would now be under the ground.
And then that would be...
Well, she's got to try and get out somehow. She did go in a hole quite a few years ago when she was young. Quite a large hole, she got dragged in. We started digging and she actually popped up about 20 feet away out of another hole, covered in clay. I've never known it.
Blimey.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. We were both digging.
Your heart rate's probably as high as hers right
My
now.
My heart rate's gone right up now. I could just see her disappearing down there. And not only that, you can break a wing. It's so easy to break a wing, you see.
Do you name them?
This is Madison.
Madison. They're beautiful. She's beautiful.
Yeah, she is good. She's a good girl.
I don't think I've ever stood so close to one. The feet, huge, huge claws. Beautiful sort of brown and black markings and big eyes. Big brown eyes.
Yeah, they got They've got a third eyelid. It's for protection. They shut that as they go into for the kill.
So that nothing can...
Exactly.
Amazing.
And the beak. The beak's is just as damaging as the feet. I mean, the feet are there to hold. It's actually the beak that they kill the animal with by going into the jugular vein. That's how they do it.
She's gone. Another, she's all right, isn't
another
she?
Another rabbit.
Yeah.
But you see, this is the bond. She knows it's what it's all about.
Yeah.
If I was to walk over there 100 yards, she'd follow me.
Right.
She knows what the ferrets are. So she sees that ferret go down. They say the hawks have got fantastic eyes, but the hearing is also superb.
Yeah.
You can hear the thumping, but she will look at the hut and she'll know 9 times out of 10 what hole that's coming from.
What does it bring to you? What do you love about doing that?
It's just being outdoors. It's just back to nature. It's just great. Love it.
Yeah, really interesting experience that was. Thank you to Nigel and Kevin, who you didn't hear from Kevin, unfortunately, but he was there, I promise. That experience was very interesting for me because I do know that this sort of stuff can be confronting for people, and I understand why. It just goes back to what I was saying around the stuff that I did with John and earlier in the show. And I mean, John, he doesn't hunt, and he says he hunts with a camera, but all of the methods that we were learning and that he teaches obviously can be used for hunting. And yeah, I know it's a difficult area for some people, and I appreciate that, but what came up again in that is the fact that we've interfered so much with the natural order of things and removed so many natural predators. So for the rabbit, you know, it would be stoats and things like that that would have gone for them and would have kept numbers down, but we've really interfered in that. So again, it kind of falls at our door. If we're going to get involved in that way, we also have to now come up with ways to manage the numbers, which are humane and decent, because myxomatosis is neither of those things, and we've all seen a rabbit with that, and it's horrifying. It's a horrible thing for it to have to suffer. So using methods like this, to me at least, it's kind of the natural order of things. You know, hawks are a predator and they do hunt rabbits, so to exercise that seems, you know, like a more decent way of doing things. It's never nice for an animal to die, we know that. And I think I heard this quote, which was, hunting makes us more animal, but killing an animal makes us more human. And we all feel that pain and remorse for when an animal dies. And I think in a lot of, in our culture previously, and in a lot of the indigenous cultures that still do hunt, there's a great deal of respect paid to the animal that's died within that process. And that's something that we don't do anymore, because we don't see that process happen. It gets bought in packets in supermarkets where someone else has done that for you. The way the meat industry is these days, in my opinion, is really disgusting and disrespectful to the animals. So if we bring it back down to these localized ways of managing numbers, of hunting, and then eating the meat that we hunt, which is key, then that just feels like a more correct way of doing things for me. And that's the way I eat. I actually only eat wild meat. I don't eat anything else. I don't eat anything that isn't traceable or that I haven't found myself. And I have tried, I will share this experience, because I have tried to shoot a rabbit before. And I was being taught by my friend, and we were out on our belt buckles crawling through, and it's actually very difficult, and it makes you realise that even to get near one of these creatures is a lot of work, and you have to learn all of the signs that we were talking about earlier in the show to be able to detect where they are, to be able to get close to them, and to respect the fact that these guys are wily and it isn't easy to kill them. So I had one lined up in my sights, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't pull the trigger, and I'm going to try again, because for me to eat meat, I think we have to know what it is to kill it, and so it's something I'm going to pursue, and I feel like it's a bit of a process, but yeah, to me it does come down to making it an even playing ground and respecting the animal that you're ultimately going to kill to eat. So thank you, Nigel, for explaining that process and for letting me in on watching how that all works. It was really quite something. So we've come to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. I have been Charlotte Petz, and this is Growing Wild on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. I really hope you enjoy the rest of your Christmas day. And if this is a podcast, you've probably heard enough about Christmas, quite frankly, and are quite over it. But if you are listening on the day, then thanks for listening and enjoy what's on, probably Strictly. It's on the telly or something like that. And I'll be back next month. So I will speak to you then and thank you for listening. And I'm going to play you out with another Christmassy number because I can't resist. And I do love this song. This is Mud and Lonely This Christmas. It's not as miserable as it sounds.
Try to imagine a house that's not a home. Try to imagine a Christmas all alone. That's where I'll be since you left me. My tears could melt the snow. What can I do without you? I've got no place, no place to go. It'll be lonely this Christmas without you to hold. It'll be lonely this Christmas, lonely and cold. It'll be cold, so cold without you to hold this Christmas. I remember the day you went away, and how I would listen to the things you had to say. I just break down as I look around, and the only things I see are emptiness and loneliness and an unlit Christmas tree. It'll be lonely this Christmas without you to hold. It'll be lonely this Christmas, lonely and cold. It'll be cold, so cold without you to hold this Christmas.
You remember last year when you and I were here? We never thought there'd be an end. And I remember looking at you then, and I remember thinking that Christmas must have been made for us. Because, darling, this is the time of year that you really need love. When it means so very, very much. So it'll be lonely this Christmas without you to hold. It'll be so very lonely. Lonely and cold.
It'll be lonely this Christmas without you to hold. It'll be lonely this Christmas. Lonely and cold.
Merry Christmas, darling, wherever you are.